So just settling into your posture. You can close your eyes or just lower your gaze. Bringing awareness into the body. I think it's almost a natural thing to do, to relax as soon as you do that, but I will suggest it anyway, just to intentionally relax the body. And see if you can tune in to the subtle ways that can happen. So there are obvious ways we can relax. Or the large muscles, releasing tension in the jaw and in the belly. But as we tune in, there also can be a more subtle kind of relaxing that happens. Almost a relaxation on the energetic level. Oh, this is sometimes characterized as, or visualized as, a kind of flow of energy down the body into the earth, so flowing out of the body, all tension, and into the earth. And this also has the added element of feeling yourselves connected to the earth. And tuning into how you're feeling right now. With a theme tonight of depression and working with that through our practice and through our recovery. One of the things that creates problems is when we don't let ourselves feel, when we avoid paying attention to our feelings. And the way that they then infiltrate our mind and our thinking. They start to sort of become more embedded, more like a norm that we're just letting be there by not addressing it. So often, if you have a difficult relationship with your emotions, there is this way in which we try to avoid. Of course, that's part of addiction itself. But paradoxically, we learn with mindfulness practice that turning toward, opening to, accepting and exploring what we're feeling actually allows us to be much less caught, much less enveloped. Feelings become something more like the weather, something that we understand comes and goes, sometimes unpleasant, sometimes pleasant, but not personal. not defining of who we are, not something we're trapped in. And so this gives us, or can give us, the confidence to allow feelings to come and go. The meditation doesn't fix the feelings, but first of all, it changes our relationship to them. So letting yourself feel. An important part of mindfulness that might get overlooked some in the way mindfulness is typically offered. This doesn't mean to become overly caught up in feelings where we become kind of narcissistic, just only interested in what we're feeling. Just that the feelings are accepted as a natural part of our experience. And connecting with the breath as a concentration object or focal point. This gives us something more neutral than feelings. Kind of refuge. It's a safe refuge, not an avoidance. So even if we are feeling, we can breathe with the feelings. This is another way that we disidentify with the feelings. The breath gives us a kind of healthy distance, not a trying to get away kind of distance, but an observing distance, one that lets us see what feelings really are. We aren't trapped. They give us that space. So keep the breath with you as you sit. Another key element of working with the feelings is seeing the relationship between thoughts and feelings. And as with the feelings, we try to have a certain space, have a different relationship to thoughts. So the thoughts are not me. They don't reflect some reality or truth. Rather, just words and images appearing in the mind, conditioned, created out of causes and conditions. And we start to see how thoughts trigger feelings, feelings trigger thoughts. And this conditionality becomes more apparent. And again, we identify less by seeing that. It's like seeing how the magician does his trick. It's no more so beguiling. We see through it. When we're able to establish this space between awareness and thoughts and feelings, it's quite natural for at least a bit more peace to come. So much of the agitation in mind is caused by identification, by being lost in a thought, lost in a feeling, lost in a memory or a plan or a resentment, a judgment. And when we see through those things, and identify less with them, there's a natural kind of default to a more calm state, That state is probably what many of us would identify as a meditative state. One which is alert and attentive, but not triggered, not agitated. It's just a feeling of ease. No need to fix anything, solve anything, answer anything. Just enjoying being. All right. So I have some notes here. Thank you all for coming. Or I don't know if you came somewhere technically, but for joining us. Some of you may be new to this. Most of people's names I recognize, but I am Kevin Griffin, and since March 17th, we've been exploring my book, One Breath at a Time, and we've kind of gotten stuck in step four. My phone is making noise, so I'm going to tell it to stop. And so, particularly now, the idea of inventory from a Buddhist viewpoint has been kind of a topic now for a couple of weeks. And, as I have this class, if you want to call it a class, I'm just doing what feels like the next right thing to do. And, as I find something like this interesting, I hope that my reflections are useful and interesting to others. So, as I said in the opening, we've been talking about the five hindrances, and so we spent a couple of sessions on desire and now talking about aversion. And then I wanted to talk about aversion in relation to depression, but start with this image that we talked about in previous sessions that the Buddha gives, similes for the different hindrances, and the one he gives for aversion is it's like a chronic disease. And I was, that struck me as being, first of all, what depression is. Very often a chronic relapsing disease, and also what addiction is, a chronic relapsing disease or condition. Even people debate this term, whether it's a disease or not. Not that interested in debates like that. It's a thing that keeps happening over and over. But chronic relapsing, and one of the things that's disturbing, when you've had a serious depression, is when they tell you that, oh yeah, if you've ever had a depressive, whatever they call it, state, been in a clinical depression, then that makes it more likely that you'll have one again. And thanks for telling me that, right? Because that thought can trigger mood, and so that's one of the things about depression that's so important, I think, is our relationship to the very idea. And this is where Dharma obviously makes a connection with it. So one of the ways we can think about depression in relation to aversion is that depression is like a chronic disease, but it's also an aversive, it's having an aversion to the way you are feeling and an aversion to your own thoughts. And both of those forms of aversion, they create feedback loops. And this is one of the things that's so critical to interrupting, is that when we have a painful emotion, it's natural to start thinking about it. And this is one of the things that the MBCT people, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy people, talk about in the part of what I was reading today, but that I've looked at a lot, is that we start thinking about it because our ordinary way of problem solving is to think about things and solve problems with our mind. But depressive feelings don't respond to that kind of solving. And in fact, the thinking itself creates a negative effect. You're trying to, as they say, close a gap that you can't close with your mind. So instead, you're creating this feeling of that kind of can't be solved, and this creates this negative loop. Let me see if I can find that particular quote. And I want to share too, for those who are really interested in this, this is, I think, the most useful book on for like just helping yourself. The Mindful Way Through Depression. It was written by the people who created mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. This is for the therapists in the crowd, but also a helpful book. But they, you know, they created this book more for therapists, and then they realized, well, why do we just want to give it to therapists? So The Mindful Way Through Depression really it's very simple, what they say. And I remember first reading it and thinking, I already know all this. And yet, it really kind of pointed to certain ways of applying mindfulness that I wasn't doing in this kind of constructive way. I want to try to see if I can find the particular quote I was thinking of, because I got a little bit lost in my... Let's see. Sometimes I start talking and then I lose what I was trying to say. Here it is. So and this is from page 42 of The Mindful Way Through Depression. The Mindful Way Through Depression, yes. Imagine yourself walking along a path by a river on a sunny day. You're feeling a little down, a little out of sorts. At first, you're not really aware of your mood, but then you realize you don't feel very happy. You're also aware that the sun is shining. You think, it's a lovely day. I should be feeling happy. Let that thought sink in. I should be feeling happy. How do you feel now? If you feel worse, you're not alone. Virtually everyone reports the same response. Why? Because in the case of our moods, the very act of focusing on the gap, comparing how we feel with how we want to feel or how we think we should feel, makes us feel unhappy, taking us even further away from what we want to be. Focusing on the gap in this way is actually a reflection of the mind's habitual strategy for trying to sort out situations in which things aren't as we want them to be. So further down on this page, focusing on the mismatch between our idea of the people we want to be and our idea of the people we see ourselves as makes us feel worse than we did in the first place. So this is like one of the critical pieces, right? This seeing through this and not getting caught in this. There's feedback loop that I think of. So what I think happens, one of the things that happens with depression is that there might be just an unpleasant, as they describe here, you have a negative thought, but there's also the negative feeling. And then the feeling triggers more negative thoughts, and then more negative thoughts trigger more negative feelings. And that starts to kind of explode out of a feedback loop, as you know, is something that creates a kind of continuous stream of energy. So with music, you know, if you put a microphone in front of a speaker, the sound starts to cycle through from the microphone into the speaker, back into the microphone, back into the speaker, and then you have that screech sound. Great, you know, great sort of image for what happens in this kind of, it's unbearable screech, and you have to turn off the microphone or turn off the speaker. So, but the way I see it with depression is that it has this enveloping effect where no longer are you just having like, oh, this is an unpleasant feeling, or that's a nasty negative thought or an unpleasant thought. It's rather our world becomes that. We become enveloped in this experience. And there doesn't seem to be any way out. And one of the causes for this, and this is something I discovered on retreat and then read about it. And so I have this both like, okay, scientifically proved and experienced directly, that which is my favorite kind because it's fairly convincing, that when we are in a particular situation, we'll just say generically, a situation, our the protective power of evolution is to trigger memories of having been in similar situations in the past. So this is how we deal with things, right? We learn over time, okay, when I hear the tiger roaring, that means there's a tiger and I should go in the other direction. You know, I've just learned that situation from, you know, having had my arm bitten off the last time I ran into that sound. Okay, that's a ridiculous version of this. But, you know, whatever, the memories are there to protect us, right? And that's useful to an extent. However, with painful emotions, what can often happen, what I think happens a lot, especially if we're not conscious of it, is that we have a painful feeling, which isn't a situation, but it creates the same effect. We have a painful feeling. And so what happens? Our memory brings up other times of having that painful feeling. Then, if you have depressive tendencies, you start to think, I always feel this way. You know, and you know, it's why when you get out of a depression and you're feeling good, you're remembering feeling good and you're thinking, what was I so depressed about? Why was that getting me? Because we don't really feel that, we're not remembering that in the same way. So it's so important to see, again, that our mind is creating so much of this. And the only way we can cut through it is to intervene with mindfulness and say, oh, this is a feeling. It's impermanent, right? So this is like the critical piece, right, that the Dharma brings in for us. That because when we're in that enveloping state, it feels permanent. It feels solid. And when we see, oh, this isn't solid, this is constructed. And I can actually see the construction. You know, it's cloudy today. I can't go outside. It's smoky. I can't go outside. I feel kind of crummy. There's a pandemic. We have a horrible president. I just want to die. Right? You know, and it's just like, there's nothing good, right? It's like, no, wait. The smoke's going to clear. We're going to vote the bastard out. And what was the other thing? Oh, yeah. The sun's going to come out. So, you know, just that remembering impermanence is the other piece. So this is the what I call seeing things through the lens of Dharma, which many of you have heard me say, but I'll remind you because I think it's a really helpful view, is to when we reflect on Dharma on a regular basis, then we tend to, instead of thinking, oh God, this is going to last forever, we think, oh, this isn't going to last forever. You know, just what a like key thing to remember all the time. So this is some of the ways that we can kind of see how this gets constructed and then how it gets deconstructed. So a couple questions I have about this, or at least starting with one, that I've been talking about Judson Brewer's book, The Craving Mind, and one of the things he says he talks about thinking as an addiction. He has actually has a chapter called Addicted to Thinking. And he says, so they talk about rumination. This is like the term that the psychologists and the cognitive therapists like to use for just when we just start, you know, thinking things over and over. And it's the, I like the word because, you know, the ruminants, and cows are ruminants, right? And I can see Jim nodding there. The chewing on the cud, right? That's what a ruminant does. It just chewing on their cud all the time. And chewing on negative thoughts, ruminating on negative thoughts is a lot like that with your mind. You're just chewing on your mental cud. Yeah. Boy, that's a gross image. So he says, could rumination be another example of being addicted? And then parentheses, continued use despite adverse consequences to a certain way of thinking. That's pretty interesting, right? Calling thinking, like negative thinking, an addiction. Continued use despite adverse consequence. That's how he defines addiction. It's not quite how I define it, as having more of a obsessive quality, but it has that same thing, the adverse consequence. He explains this, and this is one of the things that, you know, often gets kind of talked about. He explains this as in somewhat of a Buddhist way by saying people become some sort of identified with that feeling, like, oh, that's familiar, and I get that, you know, okay. And he says they've done these studies where they found that depressed people are more likely to choose to listen to sad music, you know, that well, okay. But sad music, of course, is usually the best music, so what can I say? My daughter hates sad music, so I'll just notice that she's not a depressive. Although I think maybe it's fear, but anyway, we'll talk about we don't need to bring my daughter in, she's, you know. So he goes into this thing about kind of, this is like familiar, and then people kind of become identified, which I think there's something to that, but it always felt incomplete to me. And my reflection is that it's not just that depressives identify with that feeling, but it's also that there's a belief that goes with it. There's a belief that things are bad, partly, right? There's a belief that our worldview is not inaccurate, and not just about myself, like not just about in a negative way about myself, but when you think about, I was talking about this with my wife over dinner, how people who are really positive and happy all the time are often viewed as being, sort of light, you know, not being serious, not being very bright. And indeed, I mean, even the term critic, you know, people who are critics are kind of viewed as the people who are really intelligent, who take things apart, you know, and so the sort of the happy-go-lucky person is seen as like, you don't really think deeply. The world is not really that way, you know, that's Pollyanna-ish. And so there's this not just identification, but sort of a belief in that, in the certain negative things about the world, or that there's actually, that's a sign of intelligence that we think negatively. I can literally remember, and this is sort of, there's not much actually tragic in my life, but this is kind of tragic. I remember between 12 and 13 years old, looking forward to being able to say I was depressed. Because in my family, I was the youngest of five brothers. Depression was like another sign of maturity, like drinking. And when I could say I'm depressed, I felt that that was my coming of age, like I'm an adult now. You know, I'm grown up because I'm depressed. Whew, that's depressing, right, in itself. So, all right, a couple more pieces. It was an interesting piece. Right now I need to find it. About, I think I remember it anyway. Yeah, here it is. From the MBCT people, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. So their book is kind of interesting because it's the beginning of it is kind of a survey of the attempts of psychologists to figure out how to take care of people who are depressed, and some of the things that kind of worked and things and why they didn't work, and then them arriving at this real. Well, understanding that mindfulness would really support cognitive therapy. And if you're familiar with cognitive therapy, you know it's actually pretty similar to what we do with mindfulness because it's asking you to look at your thoughts and question your thoughts and sort of, if I may, critique your thoughts, really ask yourself if they're actually true. And then they realized, you know, they got introduced to Jon Kabat-Zinn and that, oh, like if you can apply this very specific kind of practice to observing the thoughts, this would be even a clearer way to get at this relationship between thoughts and feelings. And then they tell the story of how they went to Kabat-Zinn's clinic and said, we want you to teach us how, we want to learn how you do this so that we can teach it to our clients. And he said, no, that's not how it works. You have to learn to meditate first. And they're like, no, we don't want to meditate. Like we're just here to like be therapists. And it's like, no, well, can't help you then, you know? And so they all signed up and started to take the course. And then they realized, oh, right. We need help too. Yeah, and they all become pretty devoted meditators. Anyway, that's just a, you know, book report on that book. But one of the things that I've found helpful in here in their book was talking about the elements of treatment, which these aren't exactly, this isn't exactly treatment, but the things that they said, like help people with depression. One was more pleasure-seeking or pleasure-giving activities or more joy in their lives, which makes sense, pretty obvious. Of course, this is a risk for addicts, and this is the problem for addicts, one of our many, that, you know, when someone says, well, what do you do for fun? It's like, well, I drink and then I like, you know, sleep with people I don't know. Like, is that good? No. And they're like, no, well, we were hoping to stop doing those things. Oh, well, I could, I don't know, play pool, you know? I'm pretty good at that. Poker. Actually, those, don't mean to diss those things. Those are fine. As long as you're not, you know, gambling and you're addicted to addicted to gambling. Anyway, I digress. So I think that's a really, really key piece. And it's really been important for me. And it's kind of why I've often pointed people to James Barras's Awakening Joy course. So another one they describe is social training, which is sort of an odd term, but like, you know, it turns out that many depressed people tend to isolate. Interesting. And, you know, learning to be in relationship and having more of a social existence, you know. And then the cognitive behavioral piece, changing your relationship to thoughts and feelings. Well, what struck me about all that is how closely these things are really related to recovery as well. That, you know, when you find out, oh, or whatever, you decide you're going to go to AA or NA or some program, you know, you think, oh, it's going to be miserable. And then you show up at the meeting and everybody's laughing and having a good time, right? And you realize, oh, this can actually be a source of of some happiness for you, some joy, and it brings, gives you, it takes you out of that isolating. And the reflective part of recovery, the step work, is very tied in with the cognitive behavioral, you know, looking at your stinking thinking, you know, doing your inventory, all of that, because we realized that our addiction was tied up with very negative thought patterns too. So, you know, I realized very early on that getting sober, not the not drinking, but the working a program, was really helping me to deal with depression, which is encouraging, you know, because I was thinking about the term, this morning, dual diagnosis, which, you know, they apply to people who have, are addicts and have something else. And I just wonder how many people are not, you know, they make it like, oh, that's a special thing. Like, I think most of us probably, I don't know, I'm not big on diagnosis anyway, but certainly it seems that a lot of people in recovery, a lot of addicts, I should say, not necessarily in recovery, have depression or anxiety or worse conditions, bipolar, blah, 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 et cetera. Maybe I can wrap this up, although it's another one of those topics that may wind up becoming another session's worth, and I think I'd really like to open this one up to people to talk about it. But, you know, to sort of try to put this together into a framework for us, how to think about working with this, is this, first of all, applying mindfulness to what's going on in our experience. And that, as I talked about during the guided meditation tonight, first of all, one of the hardest parts is turning toward the experience, which is something they also address in the Mindful Way Through Depression, the avoidance, the avoiding feelings. And so when we have a mindfulness practice, when we have a meditation practice, it can really help us to kind of reflectively and calmly open ourselves to a feeling, to kind of stop, breathe, and allow it to come through. And so that allows us then to see our feelings as living things, as dynamic things, which then helps us to see them as impermanent, because we see them as not static. It also helps us because as we see that, as when we feel feelings separate from thought, separate even from labels, we can actually start to see feelings as something other than emotions, and actually see them just as energies, potentially. Maybe, you know, that's something that that I work with, and sometimes I'm able to get there, and sometimes it's just like too strong. But it's really interesting to like apply mindfulness to what is this? What is this thing I call an emotion? What is this feeling? And there's nothing solid to it. So, you know, it's a choice to call it a certain thing, and it's a choice to label it. Not only to label it as an emotion, but it's also a choice to label it as depression or sadness or anxiety. That, who's telling us that that's what it is? So bringing mindfulness in this way allows us first to, you know, allow to be with the feeling, and then to separate the thinking about the feeling from the feeling itself, and to see that creation process, see how it arises, then helps us disidentify. So whether we, you know, identify, you know, tend to identify as depressives, or there are memories about these things, or we just, as I was describing, kind of believe in that view, all of that can get deconstructed with this mindfulness that just keeps stepping back and kind of just asking, well, what is happening? What am I experiencing? Is this thought true? Is this feeling permanent? Is this, do I have to? So when I first got depressed as a 14-year-old, I felt that the feeling was conveying information. And the feeling, the information the feeling was conveying to me was, there's not only is there nothing I can do about this, but I just think I'll lie down right now because I don't feel like doing anything, because it made me not want to do anything, right? Everything lost its interest, this part of one of the effects of depression, right? Sports, books, people, nothing was appealing anymore. And so that, of course, reinforces when you're passive, there's no energy, and energy is, you're not moving or doing anything, then there is a tendency to stay stuck in it. So this not believing the thoughts, not believing the feelings that the thought that are telling you things, and then having a plan. And that's another reason why a recovery program is so helpful, because a recovery program says you show up no matter what. This is what you do, and these are the things you do to take care of yourself. And I think anybody who comes to a recovery program, by the time they come to that, they've tried other strategies, right? And so we've kind of learned that, it's not very exciting, but going to a meeting is going to be better than lying here on the couch and eating junk food, And we just sort of start to, this is part of the disidentifying, is that when we disidentify and we're mindful, we can actually then make choices based on wisdom rather than based on triggered feelings. So I will, before I close, I will respond to this question from Sherry. Thank you. What about chemical imbalance and antidepressants or depressants? First of all, there's no doubt that the tendency towards depression has a physical component, if you want to call it chemical, genetic, that's there. And some people are more likely to get depressed than others. It's not as if, once I figure this out, I won't have these feelings anymore. It's really about changing our relationship to them and not becoming so enveloped in the feelings that we can't function and that we can't sort of move through them and live with them for periods of time. Because like everything else, the depressive feelings, as I've said multiple times, are impermanent. So if we can allow them to be there, but keep functioning and doing the things that bring more pleasure in our lives and bringing cognitive therapy and having social interaction, these kind of positive things, then, they don't grab hold. There's not nearly as much of a tendency to get caught. As far as antidepressants, I am not going to tell people what medication to take. I'm not a psychiatrist. I have taken antidepressants, about 15, 16 years, 15 years ago. I got on antidepressants for a while, and I was really stuck, and they helped me to get unstuck. Drugs just, they just don't provide an ongoing solution. And one of the things that the mindfulness-based cognitive therapy people talk about is they're not suggesting MBCT for people who are in a clinical depression, but rather they view it as a relapse prevention method. So that if you are in a clinical depression, to get out of it, they recommend antidepressants. And then the problem I've had with antidepressants is it's very hard to stop, and it's very hard to have a therapist. I haven't had success having a psychiatrist work with me, and I felt like the psychiatrist was addicted to the drugs, frankly, in the sense that he wasn't willing to help me to stop taking them, which is kind of a, self-perpetuating risk. And now I'm speaking totally personally here, and this is not advice, this is not medical advice, but I think it's really important if you're working with a psychiatrist with antidepressants to make it clear to them that you don't want to be on them forever, and that you want to be able to, you want them to, help you to have a plan that once the clinical depression is passed, that you will get off them, and that you'll get on a I hope mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, relapse prevention, and always be willing. I mean, if we're in those states, those suicidal states, are just really unable for months at a time to get out of those moods. We got to do something. But it's that's always a tricky deal. And I know, of course, it used to, when antidepressants first came around in the, I guess, late 80s or whatever, the modern ones, Prozac, that that lots of people in AA were like, well, you can't take drugs. And fortunately, that's that crew seems to have they're not, I don't seem to have a lot of voice anymore. I was going to say something bad about them, but it's tricky, right? I mean, we're sent, I don't know, addicts, it's like somebody offers you a pill, it's like it's a tricky thing, it always is. We always have to take care of ourselves, and hopefully you can have a sponsor who is respectful and helpful and supportive anyway. The next time we meet, I think it's going to be September 1st, Tuesday, and then the retreat, the Southern Dharma retreat, is starting on Wednesday afternoon. I think some of you are there, Jim. Didn't I see you signed up for it? Yeah, cool. Oh, Angela, you're coming too. Nice. And then we'll have the. We'll see how it goes. I'm starting to. The other day I was saying how I was like feeling aversion to it. Now I'm starting to not. So everything is impermanent. I think it's going to be interesting. We're going to have three teachers. So Greg and Walt, it's the white male contingent. It's what we got right now. But I think it'll be great to practice like that, and I'm interested to just see how it goes. I'm going to really encourage people to have a deep retreat. It's not up to me. I can't make you have a deep retreat. Even if you do everything that would allow for a deep retreat, that doesn't guarantee it. And then one would have to define what is a deep retreat. So anyway, let's just say that should be good. But I will still be here next Friday. And then I think because we're on the East Coast schedule, so that ends in the afternoon some or something. Anyway, that's on the Southern Dharma Zoom thing. So, I hope you are well internally and externally, doing what you can for yourself and for others, for this world. If you are a major in a professional sports league, I hope you are boycotting your games and voicing. Yes, it has been a tough week. It's been a tough week, tough days. I am I will tell you that tomorrow my daughter is training me to start calling people in Pennsylvania. So it's been hard for me to like get my, ass going on that, but because I started, but then I kind of felt slipped up. So I might ask her if she wants to, get other volunteers, and then I'll, see if any of you guys want to get trained up. It's not fun, to just call people and say, "Hi, I'm Kevin. I'm calling for the Democratic Party." But we got to do what we can do, at least if you care. Anyway, blessings, peace, masks, love. Take care of yourselves. Thanks. Good night.
Thank you.
Bye, Kevin.
Goodbye. Thanks, Jeff.
Thank
nice to see you.
Good night.